Crime, Wine, and Chaos contains adult language and graphic content. Listener discretion is advised.
Happy Sunday, Chaos Kids. I'm Amber.
And I'm Naomi. And this is Crime, Wine, and Chaos. Dance it out. Hi, sister.
How are you?
I'm okay. I'm doing all right. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay as well. I've got a new camera and I feel weird. Like I'm not looking at the right spot. Are you getting that vibe too?
Well, mostly it's just really close to your face. So your head is gigantic on my monitor right now.
Are you sure that's not just my hair?
You do have gigantic hair, but it's extra gigantic because of how close it seems you are to your camera. But it's fine. I love your face and I love your hair. So, you know, bigger Thank is you. Better.
Oh, yeah.
What's going on? What's new with you?
Let me think. Where did we last leave off? We played a festival in Shelton last weekend, the band. That was fun. That was so fun. So that's new. Other than that, fucking nothing. Plunking away over here. What about you? What's going on?
Short work week. We had Monday was a holiday and tomorrow I'm taking off because we're going away for another cool Cousins Club weekend. So looking forward to that. I had that weird, squeaky, annoying, whatever squeal going on the Jeep, and our brother from another mother, Jeremy, went driving around with me to try and figure out what it was. And we realized that there was something going on with one of the rotors on the brakes. Mm-hmm. And he said, it's probably just a rock between the brake pad and the rotor. And it's like carving a groove and it's making the sound. You just take it to Les Schwab. They'll take that out for free. So I go down to Les Schwab. They look at it. They pull me back to like show me, no, it's not a rock. Whoever did this work back here, like, fucked it up and they need to fix it and they need to fix it for free. And I was like, can you write that up for me? So of course I call a dealership that does all my work on the Jeep. And they of course are like, well, we need to look at it. We'll bring us that write up and we'll see what's really going on. And, you know, I had to be like that woman when I called them because they weren't going to give me a loaner. And I'm like, are you kidding me? And so anyway, I go in and they're like fake smiling at me and taking me in and like giving me the loaner, but they're like being like, you know what I mean? Like, this broad. And then like, they told me it would be days before they would even have a chance to look at it. And then later that same night, they texted me and said that the Jeep was ready for pickup. I'm like, that was fast. So I go in the next morning and they don't say a word about a price or anything. So I go in the next day, I like drop off the loaner and she's like, you just owe us for the loaner. Here you go. This is what we did. Thanks. Bye. Oh, and by the way, we do care, you know.
What?
Yeah, like it was so like clear. It was like they absolutely fucked up. They realized that they fucked up. They fixed it fast for free, replaced the rotor, fixed their mistake, sent me on my way. But they did it like lickety fucking split, like get this woman out of here.
We it was do crazy pants. Her.
Wow. Yeah, she said that to me.
Okay. That's a weird thing to say.
Yeah, it was like. So that's the highlight. That was the highlight of my week.
Oh God, that's a lot. That would be the highlight of mine too. Shit. Oh my God, sister.
But now the Jeep doesn't squeak, which was super annoying, and I'm happy about that. So, what are you drinking?
Thank you for asking. I never know if when Steven is with a PH, if it's Steven or Stefan. I always want to say Stefan.
That is like, well, you know what? It is a case by case basis. That's why.
Okay. Well, I'm going to say Stefan. This is an F. Okay. Oh, what does it depend on?
It's like, it depends on when the parents name them, how they want to pronounce it.
Oh, well, I don't literally fucking know. Okay. Well, this is an F. Stefan Miller, from Calaveras County. It's a red blend. It's delicious. Black label. Thank you.
Oh, that sounds fancy.
I'm basically fancy over here. I mean,
well, yeah, Yeah. Oh, hey.
Mm.
We have a new Chaos Kids Club member.
We have two.
We have two.
We have two. Yes. Who do we have?
Katie F.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Fuck yeah, Katie. Welcome to the club.
Fuck yeah, Katie. I'm saying it like it's a quiz. And Hamed.
Hamed, yes. I was giving him shit. I was giving him shit today. I was telling him, I'm going to go home today. We're doing a double recording tonight. We're going to put a bonus episode in the can. I was like, oh, you don't get to listen to those because you're not part of the Chaos Kids Club. And then like 5 minutes later, I get a text from Amber. It's a screenshot. And Hamed is now a member.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's how we do it around here. Guilt.
That's exactly. That's all right. Guilt and shame. That's how we get all of our Patreons to join. We love you both. We're so glad you're here. Thank you for supporting our podcast.
Thank you. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, fuck, sister. Well, do you have some crime for me?
Yes.
Oh, no.
I know. Okay. Yes. Yes, I do. I'm going to tell you. Okay. You might know the story. I did not. And I feel like it's actually, I think it's been covered by quite a few podcasts, but none of the podcasts I saw that had covered it are podcasts that I regularly listen to. So that might be why I haven't heard this one. If you've heard it, I'm still going to tell you about it. So, well,
sure. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm going to tell you about Amina and Sarah Saeed. Do you know the story?
Mm-hmm. Maybe. Mm-hmm. Go on.
So here we go. Sisters Amina and Sarah Saeed actually were typical American teens. Okay.
Okay.
They grew up in Irving, Texas, which is a suburb of Dallas. And the two were very close. They were close, and they were also close in age. They lived with their parents, Yasser and Patricia, and their older brother, Islam. The three kids were actually, all three of them were really close to each other and in age. Islam was born in 1988. Amina was born in 1989. And Sarah was born in 1990.
Dang.
Right? Bang, bang, bang.
One after another. Yeah.
Yeah. Both girls were very pretty and very smart. Amina's favorite color was pink. It was her signature color. And she was the more outgoing of the two sisters. She was very funny. She liked to talk a lot. Sarah was described as like a real tomboy. She always wore jeans and sneakers. She was really reserved, but she almost always had a smile on her face. Both girls really loved school. Sarah wanted to be a doctor. They both had big plans for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So Amina got super into Taekwondo, and it would be in a Taekwondo class that she would meet Joseph. As soon as Joseph and Amina exchanged cell phone numbers, their relationship started, and they fell in love very quickly and were in near constant contact with each other. But as their relationship deepened and they got closer, Amina started to open up to Joseph about her family and what was really going on inside her home. Initially, in the beginning, Amina would tell Joseph that she had to be careful with texting him because her father was very strict. But later, she would confide in him that her father was more than just strict. He was actually abusive and violent and controlling, and she was very scared of him.
Oh, no. Oh.
Yeah. In the award-winning documentary, The Price of Honor, released in 2014, Joseph's mom, Ruth Trotter, members of Amina's family, and various friends of the Saeeds would collectively share what they knew about Yasser, Patricia, their children, and both Yasser and Patricia's family, and a very disturbing picture emerges.
Oh, geez. Okay.
Yasser Saeed was born in Sinai, Egypt in 1957 and came to the U.S. on a student visa in 1983 at the age of 26. He was the oldest of five children. He had three brothers and a sister, And all of them came to live in the U.S. at some point, I think in the early 80s. That part's not entirely clear. The details are a little muddy. But Yasser was living in Texas, as well as at least one of his brothers, Yassin, who is the middle of the five Saeed children. The sister is the baby.
Okay.
So according to Patricia, she was 14 when she started dating Yassin, who would have been like mid to late 20s at that point.
Oh my God.
Mm-hmm.
What?
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then she broke up with Yassin and started dating Yasser, who was almost 30.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So she met them.
What's Patricia's like? Is
we'll
she
get
from
into it.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
We'll get into it. She Whoa. Met them. She met them at the little convenience store that the two worked at near the apartments where she and her family lived. She said that Yasser convinced her parents to sign the paperwork to allow her to get married to Yasser when she was 15 and he was 30.
Oh, no.
The way Patricia describes it in her interviews for the documentary, and from what I could pick up in the context of her sister and her aunt, who were also interviewed for this documentary, Patricia's family was definitely like super low income, and the Saeeds were doing pretty well for themselves in comparison. And Patricia says her dad didn't want to allow the marriage, but her mom convinced her dad it was a good idea because Yasser would take care of Patricia.
She's still... A child, and that's still your job.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Okay.
So, I'm not sure where the money is coming from that he supposedly has to take care of her since he's working at a convenience store at this time.
Right.
And in the ensuing years, when he does work, because he doesn't always work through the years, he drives a taxi.
Okay.
So I don't... But like I said, maybe it's relative because I don't want to be... Because this poor family has been through so much. Like, her family is definitely, like, not well-educated, low income, like, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, Patricia and Yasser were married with a 15-year age gap between them, and Patricia's still a minor, in 1987, and over the next 3 years, all three of their children would be born.
Oh, God.
Patricia claims that Yasser had many affairs during the course of their marriage and also had a child with another woman prior to his marriage to Patricia. So there's another kid out there that is Yasser's child that is older than Islam.
Wow.
She also says he abused her for many years, but she maintains that he never abused their children. Everyone else has a different story.
Well, Patricia. And she's texting Joseph saying that he is physically abusive.
Well, Amina is telling Joseph this. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Literally everyone else in this documentary had a completely opposite story to everything Patricia said. Oh, so we'll get into it a little bit more as we go along. But Patricia is, I have questions and concerns.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there was a whole incident when the girls were younger, like I want to say 4, 5, 6, somewhere in there, 7, that range.
Mm-hmm.
Where they tell Patricia that Yasser was touching them inappropriately.
Mm-hmm.
And this story is really muddy because Patricia says in one of her filmed interviews that she took the girls to be examined by a doctor based on these allegations and no evidence was found, even though that didn't actually rule out the possibility of the sexual abuse. The girls' statements were taken and it was as bad as you can imagine. But then the girls recanted and said they made it all up and it never happened.
Okay.
And Patricia's sister says that she had received a letter from Amina telling her that Patricia made the girls recant.
So far, based on what I know about Patricia, that sounds believable.
And Patricia denies this completely.
Mm. Wow.
There are... Throughout this documentary, home videos, like clips from home videos from the Saeed family. And Yasser was he was constantly filming home videos, like all the time. Mm. And there's a couple that they put in the documentary that are like gross. Like he's like filming the girls while they're like lying in bed. They're clothed and stuff and they're like under blankets, but he's making these comments that are like, ooh, nice legs. It's really disturbing.
Oh no. Oh
yeah,
no.
It's really disturbing. And it's like, oh, if that's how he is, like just hanging out in the house at home, like anyway, just for the sake of time, I didn't include everything that is in this documentary. Honestly, seriously, The Price of Honor, it's worth watching. It's on Prime. I think it's free if you're a Prime member. Go watch it and get like all the scoop. But it's, yeah. The one thing everyone agrees on, Patricia and everyone else, is that Islam was spoiled and treated very differently than his two younger sisters.
Mm-hmm. Also, like if he's whatever, almost 30 and his bride is 14, then right. I think we safely say that he's attracted to children.
Yeah. Or at least people that are not appropriately aged for him. Yes, mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So as the girls entered their teenage years, Yasser became even more controlling and obsessed with what Amina and Sarah were doing. Sarah got a job working at a cash register at a store of some sort, and he would sit in the parking lot and film her from inside the car. And he would get angry and punish her when he saw her smiling too much at customers.
Oh my God.
Mm-hmm.
Oh God.
When Amina turned 16, Yasser took her to Egypt to try to arrange a marriage between her and some much older man, like a friend of his. Of course, Amina was mortified and refused to do this.
Yeah, good.
Mm-hmm. So eventually, Amina and Joseph would decide that the solution to all of it would be for them to run away and elope. They were like super like in love, teenage, hardcore love. They were going to get married and live happily ever after, right? And Joseph's mom, Ruth, was totally on board with this plan. She had grown to love Amina and she was really worried about her. And she saw how the two were together and was like, yeah, why not? So... Mm-hmm. Then Yasser found a letter that Amina had been writing to Joseph. So Amina and Joseph like wrote each other letters like constantly. And Amina hid all the letters that she got from Joseph. But Yasser found a letter that she had been working on that she had yet to send to Joseph. And he was livid and he demanded to know who this boy was.
Mm-hmm.
Amina lied. And she told him that she knew she would never be allowed to marry for love. And she was just pretending as if she did have someone that she loved.
Oh, poor thing. Also, like 17-year-olds running off and getting married, this might be like the only time where I think that actually does sound like a pretty good idea.
I mean, it's one plan, right?
Yeah, better than the alternative, sounds like. Mm-hmm.
Yasser didn't believe her about this pretend story. And so he moved the whole family about 20 miles away to Louisville. Literally in like a day or two, they just packed up their lives and left Irving.
God, this poor girl.
And so for a while, Joseph didn't know what happened, if Amina was okay or anything. There was like no contact, right? She just mm-hmm. was gone. And Amina didn't and probably couldn't safely reach out to him. And then one day she sent an email to their Taekwondo teacher telling him what was going on and asking him to let Joseph know that she was okay and that she loved him. And the teacher sent this email to Joseph's dad, who in turn sent it to Joseph's mom, Ruth. And that is how Ruth and Amina started an email exchange that went on for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
Amina told Ruth that Yasser wanted information about Joseph so he could go after this kid.
Jesus Christ.
And when she told him that she would not tell him anything about Joseph, Yasser beat her. He kicked her in the stomach and then he kicked her in the face and he like fucked up her. She had braces. So like her lips got all like embedded in her braces. It was a scene.
Oh God.
Patricia says this never happened.
Okay, Patricia. Okay. Wow.
So, of course, Ruth was worried for her son's safety. She was not convinced that if Joseph and Amina started talking again, Yasser wouldn't find out. And both Amina and Ruth were afraid of what Yasser would do to Joseph if he knew who Joseph was. So right. Ruth didn't tell Joseph for a long time that she was in communication with Amina.
Mm. Oh, what a hard spot to be in as a mom.
Yeah. And it was after this move that Yasser took Amina back to Egypt She emailed Ruth before they left about how she was afraid she might not be coming back from Egypt. And she, while she was there, she sent an email to Ruth like soon after they got there and told her that Yasser had taken her passport. And then Ruth didn't hear from her for a while, but she did eventually return to Texas with Yasser. And it was clear that he was still very much trying to arrange a marriage for Amina to what Ruth called the highest bidder.
Gross.
Mm-hmm. So then the week after Christmas in 2007, Amina and Sarah finally convinced Patricia that the three of them need to leave for good.
Mm-hmm.
By all accounts, Yasser was still abusive to Patricia. Well, by all accounts, except Patricia's account, which is an ever-changing story depending on who asks her and when they ask her. The documentary literally will have like side-by-sides of her answering or talking about something. And in one, she says one thing. And in the other, she says the opposite about the same exact thing. Like constantly. So they hop in the car. They bring along Sarah's boyfriend, Eric. Sarah also has a boyfriend. And one of Amina's friends, Eddie. And it seems like Eddie was the decoy boyfriend so that Yasser still wouldn't know about Joseph.
Okay. Does he know about Sarah's boyfriend?
I don't think so.
Okay. Okay.
And so the five of them were gone for about a week.
Mm-hmm.
During this time, Yasser and his brother Yassin are blowing up all their phones, trying to convince them all to come back. Supposedly, Patricia and the girls destroy their SIM cards so they can't be tracked, and they get one burner phone to share between them. But phone records show Patricia's phone is active and in communication with Yasser and Yassin the entire time.
Oh, God. It's so hard because she's obviously a victim, too, but it's like...
So bad. It's so bad. I can't. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So eventually Patricia tells the girls that she wants to drive to visit her mother's grave for the anniversary of her mother's death, their grandmother. But once she has them all in the car and she's headed that way, she tells them, actually, we're all going back home to your dad.
No, no.
Yeah. So Amina refuses. She absolutely refuses. But Sarah gives in.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, like, no one really said this, but I feel like Amina had it worse than Sarah.
Mm-hmm.
One, because Amina was older and it was more like serious and like, right. And like, also Sarah's the baby of the family. So I just feel like Amina got it worse from Yasser than Sarah did.
Right.
But so Amina goes to a friend's house instead. And then Patricia shows up demanding Amina come back with her. And she won't leave this friend's house until Amina is in the car and coming home with her.
Oh,
again, God. Patricia's version of this story is totally different. And she claims that Amina called her and asked her to come pick her up from the friend's house and take her home. And no one believes Patricia about this part, this version of the story.
No, everyone that wouldn't else, even make sense.
No, it makes no sense. It makes no sense.
Mm-hmm.
So it's New Year's Day, 2008. Yasser is going to take the girls out for dinner, just the three of them. Patricia says that she tried to go along, but Yasser insisted he wanted to talk to Amina and Sarah alone. So they all got into his cab and left. Later that evening, a call comes in to 911. A female caller yells, "Help! My dad shot me. I'm dying. I'm dying."
Oh, my God.
I'm not going to go into all the details here about this call, but I will say this. Sarah's phone records show that her phone had an open line to 911 for 42 minutes, and the police released less than 10 minutes of audio.
Okay.
In addition, it is clear that we have another case here of an absolute fucking idiot emergency dispatcher who did not do a single goddamn thing right with this call. Some people even think that had they done a better job with this call, Sarah might have survived.
Oh, my God. No, no.
But she did not.
Mm-hmm.
Yasser's cab was discovered outside the service entrance of a hotel in Irving, and inside were the bodies of both Amina and Sarah. Amina was shot twice and died instantly. Sarah was shot 9 times.
Holy shit.
And obviously did not die instantly.
Mm-hmm.
And Yasser was in the wind.
Do you know why? Are they still using burner phones? Is that why they couldn't locate where they, like, why was there such a delay?
It was ineptitude on the part of emergency dispatch. They did not follow the protocol to track these girls down.
Okay.
If you watch the documentary, they spend a good chunk just going into all of that. And I kind of got a little lost, but like they showed a bunch of different snips from like the handbook on how to deal with situations and what to do and ways in which you can track things when there's an open phone line moving around a city. They didn't do any of those things.
Mm.
So Yasser's in the wind, and also nowhere to be found was his handgun and all of his savings.
Mm.
So at the time of the filming and release of the documentary, The Price of Honor, Yasser was still nowhere to be found, and everyone in the documentary agreed that the Irving police did not seem to give a shit about finding him and bringing him to justice for the cold-blooded murder of his own daughters.
God, wow.
Many people speculated he had found his way to Egypt with the help of one or more of his brothers, and this would make sense. According to Patricia, prior to coming to the U.S., Yasser had actually killed someone in Egypt by running them over with his car, and Yasser's... What? Yes. Like a coworker that pissed him off. And Yasser's dad got him out of the country to avoid facing the consequences there. Mm. Also, his sister, the youngest of the five Saeed children, was wanted by the FBI for kidnapping her two kids when she left her American husband and fled the country with them, also with the help of one or more of her brothers.
Wow, this family.
Mm-hmm. Oh, they're something else, let me tell you.
Shit.
The FBI would eventually classify these murders as an honor killing, which is just one of the many forms of gendered violence women around the world are subjected to, and a very specific version of femicide.
Mm-hmm.
Most often, these murders are committed by a man in the girl or woman's family, her father, her brother, an uncle, or a cousin, although sometimes it is their own mother who kills them because women support patriarchy too. Honor killings are perpetrated on women and girls for perceived transgressions against traditional gender norms like promiscuity, disobedience, and sometimes even for being raped and therefore no longer clean or whatever.
Oh my God. Fuck right off.
Mm-hmm. Ugh. The family is shamed by her behavior, and killing her restores the family's honor.
Okay.
There are areas in the world classified as honor killing zones. Honor killings occur in the traditional societies of the Middle East, the Indian subcontinent, North Africa, and immigrant communities worldwide, including Europe and the US. So immigrant communities from these places, right?
Mm-hmm.
These murderers are not only supported by their family, but by their community. They have to do this in order to restore their family's standing in the community. Very often the family would be shunned and not even able to make a living, hold their head up, or make eye contact with anyone in the community.
Wow. That is unreal.
It's insane. Statistics of honor violence are notoriously unreliable because so much of this violence is underreported. The UN guesstimates there's about 5,000 honor killings per year worldwide, but women's advocate groups estimate that much higher at 20,000 murders for honor per year.
Fuck. She didn't, I mean, it doesn't matter, but she, Jesus Christ, she had a boyfriend. That's what happened. She had a boyfriend.
Mm-hmm. There are roughly 800 million women and girls living in the honor killing zone.
Fuck.
Most Muslims would tell you that these murders are not directives from the Quran or a part of the Islamic faith in any way, and that these crimes stem from culture, not religion.
Mm.
Tribal law, not religious law.
Okay.
Yasser Saeed was never considered a very devout man or particularly religious at all. Most who knew Yasser and the Saeed family agreed that Yasser's brutal killing of his own daughters was fueled by his belief that the two girls were too American and they were beyond his control.
Okay. Too American. Okay.
Mm-hmm. So I finished this doc, The Price of Honor, and I have cried multiple times and I'm pissed now, right? And as of the release of the documentary in 2014, Yasser is still on the lam. So this was like 6 years later, right? The crew of the documentary, in conjunction with Joseph's mom, Ruth, have done some of their own investigating. They are certain Yasser's brothers know where he is and are helping him hide.
Mm-hmm.
They've tried to contact a couple of the brothers. The film crew tried to contact a couple of the brothers, and they were terrified by the response from the Saeeds. So they stopped. They also thought that Yasser might still have been in Texas And they even found a house in another town, like a small town where they think he was hiding out. And they send this info to the FBI, but they get no updates from that tip. And the FBI, you know, whatever. But they do, after this all comes out and becomes public through this documentary, the FBI places Yasser Saeed on its top 10 most wanted list.
Holy shit. And I am not convinced that Patricia doesn't know where he is based on everything I've heard so far.
And neither was her family.
Okay.
And her family agree.
Okay. Wow.
One of the complaints was that the police did not interview her. They also went to execute a search warrant on the Saeed home, and they allowed Patricia to go in and get things first. And one of the things she took, yes. And she took things that they're certain might have had information or evidence that would that would help the FBI find or, you know, add to the evidence of Yasser's guilt.
Yeah. Well, no shit. That's literally not how a search warrant works.
Right.
Go get all your shit out first and then.
Right.
Oh, my God.
So then I go to the interwebs to see what other info I can find on Amina and Sarah. And lo and behold, in August of 2017, a maintenance worker at Canyon Apartments in Bedford, Texas, recognizes Yasser Saeed while fixing the AC in the apartment of his son, Islam.
Okay.
He called it in to authorities who obtained a search warrant, but Yasser was gone by the time it was executed. They did, however, find a pair of eyeglasses in a rocky area below the balcony of Islam's apartment, and through DNA kinship analysis, were able to definitively determine that the glasses belonged to Yasser.
Mm-hmm. Fuck.
After this hit, the FBI continued a close surveillance of the Saeed family. And in August of 2020, 3 years after that close call, agents observed Islam and Yasser's brother Yassin bring groceries to a house in the rural town of Justin, Texas, that was being leased by members of the Saeed family. And they left with what appeared to be bags of trash.
Hmm.
After the two left and the sun went down, lights went on inside the home and there was someone seen walking around inside the house.
Whoa.
On the 26th of August, a search warrant was obtained and Yasser Saeed was found hiding in that house.
Oh, God. Awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Oof, fuck.
Mm-hmm. Islam and Yassin Saeed were also arrested for aiding and abetting a fugitive. In January of 2021, Islam pled guilty to harboring a fugitive, conspiring to harbor a fugitive, and one count of conspiracy to obstruct justice. And in April of 2021, he was sentenced to 10 years in federal prison.
Fuck.
It looks like Yassin pled not guilty and went to trial, claiming he hated Yasser for what he did and he would never have helped him if he had known what would happen.
Okay, sure. Yeah, whatever, dude.
Right. In February of 2021, he was found guilty of conspiracy and harboring a fugitive and sentenced in June of 2021 to 12 years in federal prison.
Wow.
Yasser's trial started 2 years later on August 2nd, 2022, having entered a plea of not guilty. Yasser had this to say about the murders of his daughters. This is not quote. This is summarization. That he disapproved of his daughter's dating activity, but he denied killing them. He said he was upset because in his culture, that is something to be upset about. He claimed he was taking them to dinner. Sorry, this guy. He claimed he was taking them to dinner. I can't. To smooth things over and solve the problem. But he thought he saw an unknown person in a car stalking them while they drove to dinner. And thinking he himself was the target, he ditched the cab and fled into the woods to steer the stalker away from his daughters.
That's very noble of him.
Isn't it?
Oh, my God. What a fucking dipshit.
Right? He also claimed he didn't turn himself in after the murders because he didn't think he would get a fair trial. His defense team claims that Yasser Saeed was targeted by law enforcement because of his Muslim faith and cultural beliefs.
Okay, fuck off. Except that Sarah called and said, my dad shot me.
She sure did.
Mm-hmm.
She sure did.
God.
In closing arguments, Yasser's defense attorney, Baharan Muse, said, quote, everybody has a preference in how they discipline their kids, just like they have a preference for what kind of food they eat, what kind of people they date, what religion they want to practice. Discipline does not mean you murdered your children. Your culture does not mean you murdered your children.
I know.
I know. But
would you just dip it? Oh, God. Fucking cannot.
Oh, Syed's defense team alleged prosecutors sought to generalize and criminalize an entire culture to fit their narrative.
I don't even have words. I know. I don't have words.
Yasser Syed's trial lasted 1 week. Jurors deliberated for 3 whole hours and returned a guilty verdict for capital murder, which comes with a life sentence without the possibility of parole.
Yes, good.
And that the story of Amina and Sarah Syed, killed for the honor of their family.
Uh-huh, sure.
Patricia is infuriating. I highly recommend, if you've never seen this documentary, go watch it. The Price of Honor, wow. No wonder it won awards. But also, like, she is just, like, you cannot believe anything that comes out of her mouth. So, like, on the one hand, you'll see her talking about the abuse and how awful Yasser was, and she's crying. And then the next thing, you see her talking in a different interview, and she's like, Yasser would never hurt his children, and it wasn't that bad, and they're over-exaggerating. She's just all over the fucking place. I can't believe any of it. Like, every word that comes out of her mouth is just fucking suspect. Because everyone else around her, her sister, her aunt, friends of the family, friends of the girls, they are all consistent with each other and with themselves. Everything they say lines up with what everyone else says and is consistent with what they've said before, except Patricia. Mm-hmm. Now, the only thing I
don't
want to
throw her
a bone, but I was about to she was a child. She was groomed. Two, the other thing I was thinking is the Syeds are dangerous. Her brothers-in-law were dangerous men. Her husband was a dangerous man. And at the time of these interviews, Yasser was still on the run. Mm. And she was clearly trying to get some kind of support still or something from his family, because I don't think she had anywhere else to get support. And also, if he's still on the run, he sees this documentary. Who knows if he shows up and murders her next, because he clearly doesn't have a problem killing women or killing anyone. So, like, but she said some of this stuff that was negative about him at the same time too, right? While he was still on the run. So I don't know, man. I don't fucking know. I don't know.
Was she subpoenaed to testify at his trial at all?
She did testify at his trial. Yeah. Yeah, she did.
And was she a defense witness that was like,
no, she was a she was a witness for the prosecution. And she said on the stand something like, you don't deserve to live. Like, you don't, she said that he should get the death penalty, which is kind of crazy that in Texas he didn't.
Yeah.
Well, I think partly because they have the 911 tape of Sarah saying that she was shot by her dad. But other than that, they actually don't have any physical evidence against him.
Right. I mean, except for a history of abuse, which
is documented. It's documented. Yeah. They showed the documents where this stuff was written up in official reports of that abuse. And there was another story of another girl in the Patricia's family who would babysit for them, who stopped babysitting because she claimed that Yasser was also sexually abusing her and she didn't want to go back there. You know, even Patricia claims that there were times when Yasser, as her, you know, husband, like, he raped her. Right. And like abused her when she didn't want to have sex with him and whatever. So, like, there's plenty of evidence that this guy's a fucking piece of shit. Mm-hmm. But there's no physical evidence that ties him to the murder scene.
Right. Wow. Well, then we can credit Sarah for providing
that heroic fucking. Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That shit with the video camera, too. That reminds me of Susan Powell, her father-in-law.
Yes. Fucking creepy, dude.
So fucking creepy. Yeah.
Just constantly. I mean, there was parts where Joseph, Amina's boyfriend, talked about how Amina was so afraid of her dad and the way that he surveilled them that she didn't even want to use payphones because she was like, he'll fucking know. Like, that's how, like, constant he was on top of these girls.
Jesus Christ. I know. Can't imagine living like that. that.
I know.
Well, fuck. Thank you for that, I guess.
You're so welcome. That
was terrible.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. Well, let's just do a hard pivot. This
hold
is
on,
not
hold on, hold going- on. And chaos.
And chaos. This is also bleak, though. Also pretty bleak.
Oh, great.
So,
all right.
I know.
So excited.
Yeah, I'm going to tell you about a volcano.
Oh, the floor is lava.
Stop it. Hot lava. God, best childhood game ever. All right. We are going to New Zealand.
Oh, okay.
We're going to the northeast coast of New Zealand called Waikitene, which is just southeast of Auckland.
Okay.
Okay. There's an island about 50 kilometers off the coast that is an active volcano. It's known as White Island. That's what it translates to in English, but it's Waikerie. Waikerie okay. Island is the volcano.
Okay.
So Matt and Lauren Yuri went to New Zealand for their honeymoon from the U.S. There's a lot of people in here, but I just want to give a little blurb about some of the people that were in this documentary.
Okay, great.
So we've got Matt and Lauren, Jesse Langford and his sister. They're there from Australia. They're described as adrenaline junkies. They have both jumped the Auckland Tower.
Awesome.
Mm-hmm. They've been whitewater rafting. They're like into it, right?
Yeah.
They go to New Zealand on a cruise with their parents from Australia. Like, what a cool cruise.
Yeah, I'm in. That's a cruise I might actually do. I'm not really super down with cruising, but there's a couple of cruises I'd be interested in. I would do that one.
I'm pretty anti-cruise, especially after almost 3 years of doing this podcast and being a consumer. I'm convinced that nothing good happens on a cruise.
What was that one Erica did? I told her to do it. It was that one that was that famous one that ferry / cruise that went aground in the Mediterranean, right? That was like,
yes. She did which a couple.
Which is so funny because a Mediterranean cruise is definitely on the list of like cruises I would actually do. But anyway, okay. So adrenaline junkies cruising with the parents.
Yep. Uh-huh. White Island is one of the most active volcanoes in the world, and they do tours there.
Fuck so, yeah, they do.
Oh, my God.
I am putting a pin in this one. We're going.
I'm not. No.
Going. No. I'm going.
I'm going to Nub City before I do this.
No way. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Ooh. So being actually on the island is like a pretty easy hike. You don't have to be like a rock climber or even like an experienced hiker or whatever. You can walk right up to the top and look into the volcano.
Fuck yes. I'm going.
No.
Yes.
Let's wait until I'm done with this story and then we'll circle back to that.
I will not be deterred. I will not be deterred. Keep going. I'm so excited.
Okay, so Jeff Hopkins is also there. He's a pastor, and he is there with his daughter, who is in college, majoring in science, and she's like studying volcanic activity. So those two are there.
Mm-hmm.
So there's tours there from the mainland over to White Island, and you can see it from the mainland, similar to like Alcatraz, or you know what I mean. Like you can see it there. You hop on a boat, you go over.
Right.
So, there were approximately 40 tourists on two separate boats heading out to White Island that day, which was December 9th, 2019, which, of course, is New Zealand's summer, right?
Right.
December.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So 40 tourists, 4 tour guides. Hayden Inman was one of the guides. His brother said that he loved the outdoors, especially in the summer, and he had been a tour guide since 2009. He had done over 1,000 trips, and he kept a diary for every trip.
Wow.
I know, which is pretty fucking cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the boat ride out is about 90 minutes, and it is rough. Which, like,
I mean,
choppy.
It's ocean. Yeah, it's ocean waters.
Mm-hmm. Or you can take a 20-minute helicopter ride.
Oh, bougie. Yeah.
Have you ever been on a helicopter?
No, but I remember you telling me about your trip on an helicopter.
No.
Amber, you couldn't even go on the Swan paddle boat.
I know. I couldn't because I was...
Amber, I love you. You are a delicate flower.
It's true. I get motion sickness very easily. I'm already a little bit nervous about being a passenger.
Sign me up for the helicopter. I am in.
Yep. So there's also a helicopter pilot that was taking people in that day. And the pilot was Brian Dupas. And he was piloting passengers by himself for the very first time on this day.
Oh, it's like a baby coroner situation. Training wheels just came off.
Oh, baby. It's a baby coroner situation. Yeah. So everyone arrives safely, and it sounds like they staggered the arrivals so that not everybody is walking up, walking back, and boating back at the same time, but there is an overlap on the island.
Sure.
Yeah. So everyone gets there safely. First impressions from the first timers said that it looks like you've landed on Mars. Like, it is so fucking cool.
Like, desolate? Like, no vegetation?
Other people call it Jurassic Park, like, because, like, and I can't do, like, science, but when you walk around, you're on top of the volcano because 90% of the mountain is actually underwater. Uh-huh. And because of there's just a whole bunch of different rock colors and formations from the steam and the lava and the minerals.
See, you're selling me even harder on this. I am so fucking down. Wait, is it still there?
Yeah. So there's okay, like there's like steamy lime colored rocks. So apparently this is called a stratovolcano, which is a specific type of volcano. So when it erupts, it isn't flowing lava like you would typically see. There's three types of stratovolcanoes. Their eruptions can be very violent and explosive, like hurling like volcanic rock, like bombs.
Okay.
Everywhere. And it's like ash and like hot fucking steam, but no flowing lava. Yeah.
Right.
So that's what we're dealing with here.
Okay. Bring an umbrella.
Mm-hmm. I don't think an umbrella would help. Okay. So the groups, the tourists are in two groups, each with two of the four guides.
Right.
The first group had Hayden and a new employee named Tiffany, who Hayden was training. Mm-hmm. Tiffany was supposed to be off that day, and he had plans to go shopping with his grandma, but he was called into work.
To train how to walk up and down the mountain.
No, he was called into work because I think another tour guide had called in sick.
Right, but he's still in training. He's still in training. Right, he's still learning how to walk up and down the mountain.
Well, I think the training, we'll circle back to that. It involves we'll get there. So the tourists are given hard hats and respirators.
Okay.
And a short safety briefing. And then they start the trek up the mountain.
Okay.
It starts from the beach and goes up to the crater, then back down. And it looks like there's like smoking chimneys everywhere. And there's like mud holes that are bubbling.
Awesome.
Oh my God. What is wrong with you?
You know, have you ever been to the La Brea tar pits in LA?
Mm-mm.
Mm, they bubble. It's cool.
Sounds like the bog of eternal stench.
Kind of.
Cool. Okay. Cool. The guide that day said that the lake is normally a vibrant blue-green, but on this day it was white due to some kind of activity from the night before, but the tourist said that everything sounded like it was totally okay and normal.
Okay, there's a lake. Mm-hmm. All right.
There's a lake. So the first group made their way back down and onto their boat, and they started to depart the island. And the second group was still on the island, just arriving at the top of the crater.
Uh-huh.
It's around 2 o'clock in the afternoon, when the volcano erupts.
Mm-hmm.
Hayden yells for everyone to run. So there, his group is on top, and they all start running down the crater towards the water. Some are able to take cover before the rocks and the ash start just like raining down on them.
Take cover where?
Behind other rock. I mean, there's no ceiling cover. There's wall coverage, I guess. Yeah.
Okay.
Oh. So the tourists leaving on the boat see the eruption, and I have pictures of it. It looks like it is thick black, like a bomb went off. Mm-hmm. And they're neat. Not too far from the... Oh, I cannot with you. Neat. So the captain on the boat instructs everyone to get inside the cabin, right? Uh-huh. And the group still on the island they're literally being burned alive. Like their skin is sloughing off.
Well, from what?
Because of the steam. Well, it's over 400 degrees Fahrenheit, and the whole island is just in steam.
Okay, that part's not neat.
That's not neat. That's zero stars. Do not recommend. That would be my Yelp review of this fucking tour.
Sidebar, I have been getting spam texts from the dealership to go and give them a review for the work that they did.
No, the first time or the second time?
The work that they did for free because they fucked up the work that I paid them to do.
Right. Sorry. Technically wasn't free. That's what they were supposed to do the first time that you paid them to do.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry. Not neat. Skin is sloughing off. Oh, man. Anything that sloughs is not good. You know, like festering and sloughing. No sloughing. Neither of those things are nothing good happened. Nothing good. Festers or sloughs. You know what I'm saying?
My God. From now on, if I'm having a rough day, I'm festering and sloughing. Yep. Yeah.
I thought you were just throwing luggage at FEMA tents.
Yep. That too. Oh my God.
So are the people on the boat like seeing this happen to these humans? Like, are they seeing that? Or are they just like far enough away that they're just seeing that shit is going down, but they're not really seeing what's going down?
They can't see what's happening because the smoke is so thick that they can't. And the people on the island can't even see their way down to the water. Like, they can't see anything.
Oh.
Uh-huh. So the helicopter pilot said that everyone's skin like looked like boiled chicken.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So about 20 people make their way down to the water. And the captain on the boat taking the first group back to the mainland heads back to the island to get people. So on top of like the fact that you have to take a boat to get there, you can't pull like the boat all the way up. You stop like, I don't know, like 20 feet from the island and you take people from a dinghy to like a ladder.
Yep.
And the dinghy holds like 5 or 6 people.
Right. Wait, where's the other boat?
It had headed... I don't know if it's like a ferry-like system. I think it had headed back to get another group. You drop off a group, you pick up a group so that it's constantly going.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Uh-huh. So with people still on the boat, he goes back to the island. He also called the mainland to let them know that the volcano had erupted with tourists on the island and that's that they needed help.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Mm-hmm.
And the Coast Guard heads out again, but it's a 90-minute ride.
Uh-huh.
And search and rescue helicopters head out from Auckland, which is about an hour and a half.
Which is also 90 minutes.
Helped by helicopter from Auckland.
From Auckland, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the helicopters are going to show up at the same time as the boats from the Coast Guard.
Uh-huh, but they don't, so we'll get there. Speaking of shitty
emergency responses. Okay. Oh my God.
So 9 minutes after the eruption, the first boat with the tourists still on it get back to the island. And they, you know, the dinghy goes over to the jetty and they start getting people as they can, but the boat gets to capacity. And so it starts making the 90-minute trip back. I think it gets to capacity after like one dinghy full because they already had that whole group, right?
Right.
So several of the uninjured who were on the leaving boat when it erupted stayed on the island to provide first aid to the people who were still on the island waiting for the next boat and to open up spots on that boat.
Uh-huh.
There were commercial helicopter pilots who saw what was happening on the island and they headed out to help because they were commercial helicopter pilots who were not in Auckland, but in the 20-minute helicopter ride from the mainland, Wakatoni.
Right.
And there was also a pilot out on his personal plane who heard over the radio what had happened, and he headed over. And so his job was basically to circle above the island and communicate to the helicopter pilots the locations of people since there was no cell phone service or anything out there, right?
Oh, my God. Okay.
So we basically have the first responders are like civilians with aircrafts.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there were 26 people on that first boat that goes back, 21 people still on the island. Two of the commercial helicopters that jumped in to get to the island first and start helping people, they're like clearing people's airways. The tour boat going back ends up meeting the Coast Guard en route, and two paramedics from the Coast Guard boat jump onto the tour boat to assist while the Coast Guard boat continues to the island.
Right.
It's just a shit hot mess, right?
Yep.
So a triage is set up.
Hot mess.
It's a fucking hot mess. It's literally a steamy
So steamy pile of shit hot mess.
Shit hot steam. So a triage is set up on the mainland waiting for the incoming boats. And several of the family members of the people on the island are waiting for news about their loved ones, right?
Right, of course.
So then the people in air get word back from air traffic control that they have been instructed that it is a no-fly zone due to the toxicity of the smoke and that it is too dangerous for the rescue workers and there is a high likelihood that the volcano is going to explode again. So basically, the pilots heading over from Auckland are called off. Further Coast Guard heading over is called off. Too dangerous.
I'm sorry, what?
Yep. But the civilian people that are already helping are basically like, fuck that. And they continue on anyway. And later, like, I didn't take a deep dive into it, but like they were got into legal trouble for flying after whoever, like the I think they have a prime minister over there said no fly zone.
Are you shitting me? They ended up getting like slapped with fines and whatever. Yes. Because they stayed and helped.
Yes. Yes.
Like, okay, but this is like a, this isn't a private fucking island with private fucking tours. This is a New Zealand national, I'm assuming a national park or a national treasure or what the fuck ever, right? Like this is not, like this is their job. This is the fucking government's job if they have a government sponsored fucking, can you imagine? Yep. I'm thinking about like, and I hate to evoke this, but I mean, think about all of those first responders in Manhattan that like ran into those buildings, even though it was like toxic and dangerous.
I know. I know.
Nobody told them they couldn't do that.
No.
That's what they do. That's what they do. They go towards the dangerous thing to save people who need saving.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Wow. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So thank God for these civilians that are just well, whatever. Yeah. So the first helicopter gets five people in and heads to the hospital. The second helicopter was able to get three in. A total of 12 injured were taken off the island between the three helicopters. There were eight on the island who were deceased. Among them was Hayden, the outdoorsy tour guide, and Tiffany, who were called in that day. Jesse Langford, who was the adrenaline junkie with his sister, lost his entire family.
His mom and dad and his sister all died, but he made it.
Well, yeah. His mom died on the island. His dad died shortly after arriving at the hospital, and his sister's body was never found.
Oh, man. Oh, that's rough. Ugh. Oh, God.
Yeah, the husband and wife, Matt and Lauren, who were on their honeymoon, survived, but both of them had severe burns. And when I say severe, I've never, they still look like, I mean, they're beautiful, but it boiled chicken is accurate for their skin.
Oh my God.
Yeah, they both still have several surgeries per month to this day for skin grafting.
When did this happen? This was
2019.
Oh my God.
Mm-hmm. So the volcano had erupted many times in recent history, including several times in the 80s. There was a major eruption that formed a new crater in 2000, and small eruptions occurred in 2012, 2016, or 2013 and 2016. So the volcano had been showing signs of unrest for several weeks, and this was 2019. So like the previous two was like 3 years and an eruption, 3 years and an eruption. So like they, in a lot of ways, should have known, you know what I mean?
Well, and also like the other thing is like, as far as I know, what little I know about volcanologists is that like the people that study this stuff and like these, especially active volcano sites, like they are highly monitored and censored. And like, I mean, they know what's going on with Mount St. Helens, like at any time of the day, day or night, every fucking day of the week. Right. They even monitor like Mount Rainier. Like we know where the fucking volcanoes are and what they're doing at all times. And we usually have in 1980, when Mount St. Helens went off, they had weeks of warning. They knew long before it was going to happen. That's why there were so few fatalities, because they saw it coming and they cleared everybody out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, in October of this year, so 2 months before this happened, volcanic tremors and sulfur dioxide gas were at their highest level since 2016, indicating that an eruption was likely to occur. And they didn't shut it down and they didn't.
Jesus. Yeah. They must have been making some money off of this venture.
Yeah.
Big tourist attraction.
Yeah, several lawsuits have been filed by survivors against White Island Tour Company claiming that the risk was not properly communicated to tourists, and trials are set for July of 2023, so next month.
Oh.
And some of those are appeals, I believe, filed by the civilian pilots who are appealing their
charges or fines or whatever. Yeah.
Fucking wild. Wild.
Wow, sister. Mm-hmm. Wow. I never heard about that. That is crazy pants.
Yeah.
I do still want to go.
That was a documentary on Netflix.
I still want to go.
No. I feel so bad. So the husband and wife, they were on their honeymoon, and like he's super also like kind of adrenaline outdoorsy, and she's like an indoor cat. And he had to talk her into this. Like,
oh,
basically, like, this is just like, she's like, he's like, it's not mountain climbing. Like, it's like a chill, just like walk, and it looks cool. And so he like, I mean, they're like the cutest couple, and she doesn't feel any type of way. But just hearing that was like, yeah, fuck, man. He felt so bad.
Of course. Yeah. Okay, well, I'm going to wait until the next eruption and then go like right after that.
Oh,
it'll be fine.
Well, that should, I mean, if they're on any kind of schedule, that should be December-ish.
Yeah, anytime now. Yep, anytime now.
For the end of this year.
Mm-hmm. So New Zealand next year, so I can go to an active volcano and look down inside. Woot!
I'll be on the mainland having a cocktail waiting for you. I'll have lunch and a cocktail and watch from the mainland.
Will you get a line on a private helicopter just in case, though?
Absolutely, sister. Yeah.
You know, there's an app for that.
Oh.
You ever heard of that?
Well, I'll make
sure. It's called Blade. It's like Uber, but for helicopters.
I feel really stupid right now. Are you making that up?
No, I'm not. I'm totally serious.
That's a fucking thing.
That's a fucking thing.
Okay. All right. Well, then, yeah, I'll fucking get the Blade app going. Okay.
Great. I'll pay you back. I'll pay you back. You know what? You can use the emergency bail fund money. And I'll replenish when we get back to the mainland. Okay.
All right. I take Venmo and sell.
Okay. Perfect. Okay.
I fucking love you. Anything else for the good of the day?
I love you too.
Damn it.
And you know, all the things, we're on all the socials, the Facebook and the Instagram and the Twitter. You can follow me on Twitter at Misnomers. Amber's in a rock band, Tinfoil Top Hat. They're on all the platforms. Go check them out. They fucking rock. And
we're about to, after our little break here, record a bonus episode. And if you're like, I need more of Amber and Naomi, go to the fucking Patreon. And for $5, you can sign up. And then you too can listen to the bonus episodes.
Just like Hamed did today and Katie.
Yes, exactly.
You know,
be like
up.
Hamed and Katie.
Be like Hamed and Katie. Yes. And yeah. Come along, because it's always fucking chaotic.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Crime, Wine, and Chaos is produced by 8th Direction Records. Artwork by Joshua M. Davis. Music by Paul Abner. If you would like to support the show, you can visit our Patreon page at crimewineandchaos.com/Patreon. Cheers.
I always want to say Stefan.
Bring us that write-up and we'll see what's really going on.